Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Healthy Skeptic Podcast. My name is Danny Roddy of DannyRoddy.com, and with me is Chris Kresser, health detective and creator of ChrisKresser.com. Chris, how are you doing, buddy?
I'm good, Danny. How are you?
I'm doing great, man.
Yeah, I'm a little... Actually, Sylvie's been sleeping pretty well. It's kind of... She's 11 weeks tomorrow, which is kind of unbelievable.
Amazing.
Yeah, it goes so fast. I already miss, like, some of the earlier weeks, you know, because she's grown, she's getting so big so fast. But she sleeps well. It's just that, you know, if Alan, like, when Alan is nursing her, wakes up to nurse her, I'm kind of a light sleeper, so I'm somewhat aware of that. So I'm not sleeping that well, but, you know, big surprise, right?
I mean, I can't imagine having that factor in on my sleep, like, just with work and everything else. It seems, like, hard to get, like, a good night's sleep and then have a child factor, and it seems pretty difficult.
Yeah, and I've only got one. I mean, I'm trying to figure out how people have five kids, you know. I mean, my older brother's got four kids under the age of eight and, you know, a startup company, and it's just crazy. I don't know how he does it.
So maybe some kind of amphetamine or something?
Yeah, I guess so. What's new in your world?
Nothing much, just researching. We'll talk about this more at the end, but just entrenched in books and sticky notes for my book. So
cool.
That's literally been consuming all my time.
Yeah, I know the feeling.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure it's about a tenth of as much work as the Healthy Baby Code, because the amount of content in there is crazy.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it. Let's talk about it a little bit at the end.
Definitely. Do you want to talk about the cholesterol studies?
Yeah. So this show, we're always kind of playing around with format, but I just kind of do what I feel like doing. Hopefully that works for all of you listeners. We're going to talk about a couple of studies that I came across this week that I think will be of interest to a lot of people. And I'm going to kind of contextualize the first one with a mini case study, so to speak. A family friend of mine called me up this week. She's in her mid-60s, and her daughter is actually a patient of mine. And I put her daughter on the paleo diet, or she already was kind of on it. But her mom and dad went on it too, which is pretty cool, because they grew up in the town that I grew up in, and I don't think there are a lot of people on the paleo diet in this town, but apparently there's like a paleo revolution going on down there, especially my parents' age group. So these are friends of my parents, and she called me up. She's in her mid-60s, recently adopted a paleo diet, and her total cholesterol and LDL cholesterol have gone up.
Oh, no.
You know, so this sounds familiar, right? Been a lot of discussion about this in the blogosphere recently. And, of course, she went into her doctor, and she feels great. I mean, she absolutely loves the paleo diet. She feels really good on it. You know, a lot of her symptoms have improved, I think, and doesn't feel ill in any way at all. But she went into the doctor, and the doctor noticed that the cholesterol went up, and guess what he wants to do?
I have no idea.
He didn't tell her to eat more saturated fat. So he wants to put her on a statin, and she called me up because she was, you know, reluctant to do that, and yet was still, you know, a little bit concerned about the increase in total and LDL cholesterol. So she had the full cardiovascular workup. She had scans, you know, for atherosclerosis, and all of the tests were completely clear. You know, the doctors were like, according to all this, you're completely free of heart disease, but we still think you should take a statin. So, ironically, you know, in a serendipitous piece of timing, there was a study published the morning that I was going to talk to her. This study came out. It's called, "Is the Use of Cholesterol in Mortality Risk Algorithms in Clinical Guidelines Valid?" 10 years.
Catchy title.
Yeah, all these studies are really, I mean, they need a marketing department, right? 10 years of prospective data from the Norwegian Hunt 2 study, and it was published in the Journal of Evaluation and Clinical Practice, which I don't know that much about. But what basically what they were looking at, they were analyzing data from a 10-year prospective trial that took place in Norway. And they looked at over 52,000 men and women, so a big study, aged 20 to 74 years old, so a big, wide age group, over a period of 10 years. So it was a pretty long study period. And that's over 510,000 person years in total. So pretty significant sample size. And I'm going to read a few quotes from the study, and then we're going to talk about the data and the conclusions, and then we'll bring it back to the case study. So the first quote is, "We have shown that according to authoritative cardiovascular disease guidelines, 75% of the adult Norwegian population would be deemed at risk for cardiovascular disease and in need of clinical attention." And what do you suppose that clinical attention would be, Danny?
Again, I have no idea.
So basically what they're saying is, according to the current guidelines for heart disease, over 75% of the adult Norwegian population would be recommended to take a statin.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's definitely something like, if I inquire on on people what they're taking, statins are definitely the most popular besides diabetic medication.
Well, they are, I think, the most popular drug category right now. Or they were at one point. They're right up there with antidepressants. Yeah. So that's crazy, right? 3/4 of adults should be on statins. And that's no coincidence, right? Every year, the drug companies keep lowering, trying to lower the recommended total cholesterol and LDL cholesterol because they're running out of patients. And the only way that they can get more patients is to lower the targets so that basically at some point everybody would be, advised to be on a statin, which of course is ridiculous. So the next quote, "In particular, we challenge the widespread assumption of a linear relationship between total cholesterol levels and disease development, expressed as mortality in our analysis." So they're saying that, this idea that the higher your cholesterol is, the higher your risk of death from heart disease and from cardiovascular disease and from any cause, they're challenging that, which is such a relief to see in a big study. So next quote, "In the past decades, a number of studies have found a strong and graded association between serum cholesterol and mortality from heart disease. Regarding total mortality, however, that association has not been clear. Some studies have found no association, and others have even suggested an inverse relationship." So another translation is they're saying there have been a lot of studies that have found an association, not a causal relationship, but a correlation between cholesterol and and death from heart disease. But the relationship between cholesterol and death from all causes, or even death from cardiovascular disease, and I'll define the difference in a second, has not been clear. And even in some cases, studies have suggested that higher cholesterol actually confers a lower risk of death from all causes. So just in the context of what we're going to be talking about, the difference between heart disease and cardiovascular disease is, heart disease just refers to exactly that, heart disease, whereas cardiovascular disease is a broader category that includes heart disease but also includes stroke. Okay, so let's talk about what they actually found in this study. What they found was that for women, there was an inverse linear relationship between cholesterol and all causes of death. So they used women with cholesterol of 195 milligrams per deciliter or lower as a reference point. And then they looked at 3 different groups: women with cholesterol between 195 and 230, between 230 and 270, and between 270 and above. So, any cholesterol above 200 in this country, you're basically going to be advised to take a statin.
Danger zone.
Danger zone, yeah. 200 is out of the lab range. I see this, I work with people all over the country, so I see lab ranges from all over the country. They're all consistent. It's anything above 200, you should take a statin. Okay, so what they found is that I mean, conventional wisdom would say that in each of those groups, the risk of death from heart disease and all other causes should go up, right? In a linear fashion. That's the general idea. But guess what? In every single group, including the women who had cholesterol levels over 270, they had a lower risk of death from heart disease, from cardiovascular disease, and from all other causes. So, I mean, this is big bells should be going off somewhere. You know, this is huge. And of course, it will probably just be brushed under the table. And, you know, you won't see a lot of news reports about it in the media. I haven't seen any mainstream media stories about it yet. But when you look at the hazard ratios in the actual table in the study, they're lower in every single category for women across the board. So this is pretty big news. And of course, I shared this with my family friend who I was talking to, whose doctor wanted to put her on a statin. And I printed out, I sent the study for her so she could print it out and take it in and say, "Why do you want to kill me, doctor?" if we put this another way, women with cholesterol under 195 milligrams had a higher risk of death from all causes than women with cholesterol above 195 milligrams per deciliter. And this was adjusted for age and smoking and blood pressure. In men, it was similar, actually, a little more complicated. So there was an inverse linear relationship between cholesterol and deaths from all causes and cardiovascular disease. So in other words, in the same way with women, men with cholesterol under 195 milligrams per deciliter had a higher risk of death from cardiovascular disease and all causes than men with cholesterol between 195 and 270 and up. But for men with heart disease, the curve was not linear. It was U-shaped, which means that men with cholesterol below 195 and above 230 had a higher risk of heart disease than men with cholesterol between 195 and 230. So it appears, just purely from an association, correlation standpoint, that having cholesterol between 195 and 230 as a man is kind of the sweet spot for mortality only from heart disease. But I don't know about you. I'm more concerned with mortality from all causes.
Totally.
Because if I am less likely to die from heart disease, but more likely to die from cancer, that doesn't really help me out. And unfortunately, a lot of these studies don't even look at total mortality. So this was great that they did and that they reported on it. And even with the heart disease mortality, we have to keep in mind that it's an association. It's not a causal link. So one could assume that a guy with cholesterol of 270 following a paleo diet and exercising regularly and managing his stress is going to have a very different heart disease risk than a sedentary person with cholesterol of 270 that is not managing stress and not taking care of himself.
It doesn't sound like it, but were the researchers proposing mechanisms and or why the higher cholesterol is predictive, like the antioxidant effect or anything like that?
They didn't go into mechanisms at all, but that's a good point. And we should talk a little bit about that. Cholesterol, as I'm sure a lot of people who are listening to this podcast already know, is not just an evil nutrient that was put into our body so that it would kill us and we'd need to take, to support the statin industry, which is kind of what it comes off as in the mainstream view sometimes. But it's a crucial substance that plays so many important roles in the body. As you mentioned, it's an antioxidant. It protects against oxidative damage, which is actually, according to the most recent research, oxidative damage and inflammation are really the primary causes of heart disease. And then in terms of, protecting us from death from other causes, cholesterol is a precursor to all of the hormones in the body, and hormones are really ruling the show, as you know, Danny.
Totally.
Cholesterol is a really important nutrient in the brain. It's needed for production of the myelin sheath, which is the insulation that surrounds the nerves in the brain. If you think of the brain as a big tangle of wires, the myelin sheath is the insulation that surrounds those wires, and it's responsible for conducting nerve impulses. It's a precursor to neurotransmitters. It just, you know, it's, there's so many things that cholesterol does that's important and that could protect us from disease. It's also, as Paul Jaminet has pointed out, plays an important role in immune function. So when you lower cholesterol, especially below, you know, this target in the study, 195, and I've seen other studies, you know, with where mortality risk doubles when your cholesterol drops below 160 or 150. Those are some of the potential mechanisms, and it's just a, and this is especially true as men and women age. So, because as we age, there is more oxidative damage, more of a risk of oxidative damage, and more of a need to prevent neurodegeneration and protect our brain health. So, you know, it's a big deal. It's something that a lot of people are still, even in the paleo community, worried about bringing their cholesterol down. I've talked a lot about this, so we won't spend too much time on it. But high cholesterol can be a risk, can be a marker for other problems like poor thyroid function. You know, Chris Masterjohn and I talked about that a lot on our podcast. So if you missed those, make sure to check them out. But the point here is that high cholesterol alone is not a risk factor for death from all causes for men and women. And in some cases, it's actually protective, meaning lower cholesterol would increase your risk of death. So let me read another quote from the conclusion of this study. Many individuals who would otherwise call themselves healthy struggle conscientiously to push their cholesterol under the presumed danger limit, i.e. the recommended cutoff point of 195, you know, 200 milligrams per deciliter. Coached by health personnel, personal trainers, and caring family members, massive commercial interests are linked to drugs and other remedies marketed for this purpose. It is therefore of immediate and wide interest to find out whether our results are generalizable to other populations.
Wow.
Pretty cool, huh?
That's, I mean, I don't read as many studies as you do in detail, but that's... it's pretty, like, indicting.
It's pretty forceful.
Like, yeah.
You know, researchers tend to be, you know, they don't make really powerful statements like that very often. They tend to be a lot more circumspect and cautious in their appraisals. But that was, you know, that's pretty clear. So... just one other thing before we go on. Even if high cholesterol were a risk factor for women, which this study clearly suggests that it's not, you know, is taking a statin a good idea? That's another question to ask. I'm frankly surprised that doctors are still recommending this to some extent, I guess, because there's been a lot of studies and a lot of even mainstream press showing that statins don't really benefit women. In fact, there was a really... a big article in Time magazine not too long ago that covered this. And I think around the last statistics I saw were around 15 million women are routinely prescribed statins, which, as most of you know, carry a pretty serious risk of side effects and complications. And yet there's almost no evidence. There is no evidence that I'm aware of that they reduce the risk of total mortality. And there's a lot of evidence that suggests that women are even more likely than men to suffer side effects from statins. So there are some studies that suggest statins may reduce deaths from heart disease, but they don't reduce overall mortality. And as we just talked about, disease substitution is not really an acceptable outcome. If your risk of heart disease goes down, but your risk of dying from cancer or some other terrible disease goes up, That's not acceptable for most people. So any woman out there who's listening to the show or who knows, you know, other women, your mom, sister, friends, colleagues, whatever, who are taking statins, you know, go use the Google machine to to search for, you know, Time Magazine statins and women, and I think that article will pop up and you can send it to them, because there's really absolutely no reason for any woman to be on a statin at all in light of what we've just talked about. Let's talk a little bit about this other study I looked at. I was, you know, dorking out this week. So this one was about normal blood sugars during pregnancy. So it's relevant, you know, for anyone who's pregnant or thinking about getting pregnant, who has blood sugar issues or suspect they might have blood sugar issues. It's a new study, and they looked at the current recommendations for blood sugar targets, you know, what women should keep their blood sugar under who are diabetic or pre-diabetic during pregnancy. And what they found is that the targets that they had recommended were higher than they should be. And the way they figured this out is they looked at a bunch of studies, I think 12 or 13 studies, that used 24-hour glucose monitoring of non-diabetic pregnant women to figure out what normal blood sugar during pregnancy is. And they found that normal blood sugar in pregnancy is lower than was previously thought. And so that the targets for diabetic women should be the same. You know, they should be lower. They're trying to get their blood sugar down to that normal level, because the issue is that high blood sugar during pregnancy can cause macrosomia, which is excessive birth weight, and that in turn changes gene expression that negatively impacts blood sugar regulation and metabolism for the rest of the baby's life. So I think we talked about this before when we did the podcast on the fetal origins theory, where changes that happen in the womb don't only affect the baby right at birth, but they actually can cause epigenetic changes that, you know, alter gene expression and metabolic function for the rest of the baby's life. So it's pretty important to pay attention to.
What were the normal ranges for, like, in actual values?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you. Good question. So the normal ranges for non-diabetic women were probably lower than you would expect. And one reason is that blood sugar is lower in pregnant women because they have a higher blood volume. So, you know, blood sugar naturally should be lower for pregnant women than non-pregnant women. But anyways, the normal markers or the normal values were for fasting blood sugar, 71 milligrams per deciliter plus or minus 8 milligrams per deciliter. So anywhere from 63 to 79, which is pretty low, right? I mean, it's yeah, lower than the normal target. The 1 hour post meal number was 109 milligrams per deciliter plus or minus 13. So that would be 96 to 122 1 hour after a meal. And then 99 plus or minus 10 for 2 hour post meal. So that's 89 to 109, 2 hours post meal. And For people who aren't aware of what, you know, post-meal blood sugars are, there are several different ways of measuring blood sugar. One is fasting blood sugar, and that pretty much just tells you what your blood sugar was that morning. It's can be affected by a lot of different things, like what you ate, you know, the day before, the night before, even how you slept, and whether you exercised before the test or not. Then there's hemoglobin A1C, which is essentially an average of a measure of your average blood sugar over the last 3 months. That is not very accurate because it can be affected by a lot of things, most particularly red blood cell turnover rate. And then the most accurate way of determining your risk of blood sugar complications is measuring post-meal blood sugar. So they measure your blood sugar right before you eat, and then an hour after you eat, 2 hours after you eat. You can do this at home with a glucometer, which is a device that diabetics, you know, use to measure their blood sugar, where you prick your finger and put a little drop of blood on there. But they usually do it, you know, in a clinical setting. It's the oral glucose tolerance test, where you fast and then you consume like a 50 to 75 milligram bolus of pure glucose, and then they measure your blood sugar 1 hour and 2 hours after that. And that's how a lot of women end up getting diagnosed with gestational diabetes. So in light of those targets for normal non-diabetic women during pregnancy, the researchers in this study suggested that pregnant women with diabetes or pre-diabetes should be no more than one standard deviation above the mean for those targets, which means that for fasting, that would be 79 milligrams per deciliter is the upper end of the limit. For 1 hour post-meal would be 122 milligrams per deciliter. 2 hour post-meal would be 110 milligrams per deciliter. So again, these limits are lower than what were previously issued. You know, previously it was 140 milligrams per deciliter at 1 hour and 120 at 2 hours. And those are still the limits that are recommended for non-pregnant women. So if you are, you know, if you have blood sugar issues, you're diabetic and you're going into pregnancy, you're pregnant, what you can do is use a low carb diet to try to keep your blood sugar under those targets. And you can use a glucometer and measure yourself, keeping in mind that glucometers are not 100% accurate. There's usually a little bit of a sort of plus or minus margin of error of either 5 or 10 points in either range. So, you know, I don't usually recommend the oral glucose tolerance test, but it might be a good idea to do once to get a really accurate reading on what's happening. But the glucometer, I think you can use and just to establish trends. And if you're staying well below these targets, you'll be fine. The challenge, though, is not to go too low with blood sugar, because that can also cause problems. Very low carb diets are ketogenic, and ketogenic diets are not a problem in non-pregnant women. But in pregnant women, they're not a good idea, because they signal to the baby that the baby's being born into an environment of scarcity. And this actually causes epigenetic changes that predispose the baby to store excess calories once they're born, you know, in order to protect against starvation. So it's an evolutionary mechanism where the baby thinks it's being born into an environment where it's not going to be fed. So the genes get changed so that the baby stores whatever calories it does receive. But unfortunately, once those genes are switched on, the metabolic changes are lifelong. So you don't want to be on a ketogenic diet during pregnancy for that reason. And another issue with ketogenic diet that I'm sure you'll appreciate, Danny, is that they tend to downregulate T4 to T3 conversion. And so they may negatively impact the thyroid function of the baby. So it's best to find a middle ground, you know, where you keep carbohydrate intake within a range of about 50 to 100 grams to avoid ketosis. And you can test to make sure you're avoiding ketosis with the keto sticks. You can usually get them at a drugstore. And then if you can't lower your blood sugar eating that amount of carbohydrate, you know, to the point where you're not in ketosis, it's probably a good idea to find a practitioner who's familiar with this kind of stuff to, you know, use either natural or conventional options to lower your blood sugar. So insulin would be one of the options on the conventional side, and it's safe during pregnancy when it's used correctly. And a lot of gynecologists know how to use insulin better than some endocrinologists that are treating diabetes, because they have to really pay close attention, you know, during pregnancy to how it's used. And then on the natural side, you have things like gymnema and L-carnitine and acetylcysteine. There's an herb, Chinese herb called fuling, poria cocos, which is a fungus that's been shown to restore insulin sensitivity and glucose tolerance, green tea extract and things like that. But it's definitely find some help, you know, don't just go out and buy all that stuff and start taking it, because obviously there are some herbs that are not safe to take during pregnancy. Most herbs are not safe to take during pregnancy, and a lot of nutrients and supplements aren't either. So definitely find someone who's experienced working with pregnant women. Last thing I'll say about that is abnormal blood sugars during pregnancy are often a sign that blood sugar was abnormal before pregnancy, but it was just missed. Because a lot of women wonder, well, why do I all of a sudden have diabetes now that I'm pregnant? And often it's just the first time they've received that kind of testing. So I think that's it for that study.
Awesome.
Go on to the questions now, if we have any time for them. Bring on and on.
You got it. Do you want me to skip any of these specifically, or just go down the list?
Let's see. Let's just go down the list.
You might be able to get to all of them. This first question's from Aaron. This is a Facebook question. Is there any science behind breaking weight loss plateaus on low-carb diets by temporarily increasing carb intake?
I haven't seen any studies that specifically look at that. Have you?
No. I've seen the metabolic rate stabilized with increasing carb intake, but there's one overfeeding study on carbohydrates that increases like T3. So I don't know if that would count as what you're talking about.
I mean, I've seen a lot of study. I've seen not a lot, but I've seen studies on, you know, metabolic function and weight loss. So, and we can presume mechanisms. Like, we know that a very low carb diet can reduce conversion of T4 to T3, like we just, you know, talked about in the context of the pregnancy study. And then we know there are studies certainly that show that poor thyroid function contributes to weight gain or inability to lose weight. So if we kind of piece things together, we can assume that we can make an argument for a mechanism by which increasing carbohydrate intake could, kickstart the weight loss again, if that person's inability to lose weight was due to poor thyroid function in the first place.
Totally.
So that's what I would say. I haven't seen any studies like specifically taking people who are on a low carb diet and then adding carbs back in and then showing that that causes weight loss. If, you know, I think that was the question. I haven't seen any specific studies like that, but we can make an argument for a mechanism based on that. And I can say from my clinical practice that it's mixed. You know, some people on a low carb diet, they plateau and stop losing weight, and I have them start adding carbs back in, they actually gain weight. But other people, when I do that, they start losing weight again and they feel better. So I think, again, this is very individual. It's tempting to try to, you know, make a one-size-fits-all approach, but it just doesn't work like that.
I do know after like my 2 years of zero carb, I switched to a pretty high starch diet, and I gained, it took me months before I actually went down a lot in weight. But I was pretty tubby for a while.
Yeah. And it may be that these patients, that would have happened if they kept going for long enough. But in most cases they weren't, you know, willing to do that experiment. So.
Cool. Good stuff. Okay. Let's get to next questions. Also a Facebook question. This one's from Winnie. There's so much information out there. Could you simplify it and give some simple best practices for people with Hashimoto's disease?
Okay. So Hashimoto's, for people who don't know, is an autoimmune disease that affects the thyroid. And basically the body attacks the thyroid gland as if it were a foreign tissue instead of self tissue. It's the number one cause of thyroid problems in the developed world, whereas iodine deficiency is the number one cause in the developing world. And those two can actually go together. The most important thing to understand with Hashimoto's, and I talk about this a lot with my patients because I have a lot of patients who have Hashimoto's, is that the root of the problem is not the thyroid. The root of the problem is the immune system gone out of whack. So it follows then that the key to successfully treating it over the long term is to balance and regulate the immune system. And that's the reason that conventional treatment often fails, because they don't address the immune dysregulation. All they do is give thyroid hormone, which I think is actually appropriate in the case of Hashimoto's, but it's only addressing the symptom. It's not addressing the underlying cause. And so what happens is women will get on thyroid hormone at a certain dose, and over time they'll have to generally increase the dose or even switch to a different medication or add a medication, because the immune attack is just continuing to go on and it's destroying more and more thyroid tissue. And as that thyroid tissue is destroyed, the capacity of the thyroid gland to produce hormone is destroyed. So you get on this kind of treadmill and it just gets worse and worse over time, and the body just kind of falls apart. So my focus is to try to short circuit that process by, you know, putting the brakes on the immune attack against the thyroid gland. And the way to do that is there are some fundamental factors that need to be considered, and then there are some more specific things. Fundamentally, the things that contribute to proper immune function are blood sugar regulation, oxygen deliverability, so the capacity of hemoglobin to deliver oxygen to the tissues and cells, proper gut function, so, you know, treating any gut infections, restoring gut barrier integrity, proper adrenal function, so about regulating the cortisol, melatonin, circadian rhythm, making sure the adrenals are producing enough cortisol or not too much cortisol. Fatty acid balance, so this is the omega-6, omega-3 balance we talk about so much, because when that's out of balance, that can cause a lot of inflammation, which can exacerbate the Hashimoto's. And then liver and gallbladder function, since those are the primary organs of detoxification. So the first thing I do is focus on all of those kind of fundamental mechanisms and make sure that they're working well, they're operating, they're functioning well. And then we would move on to more specific focus, which is balancing the two different sides of the immune system that tend to go out of balance in autoimmunity. And that's the Th1 and the Th2 side. And let's see. I don't think I want to go into a lot of detail on this because we could get off on a big tangent.
That is a gigantic
ramble. Yeah. So basically, the way to think about it is your immune, and this is an oversimplification, but you have two sides of the immune system, and one side is responsible for the first line of defense, like when you get exposed to a virus or a pathogen. These cells attack it without really even knowing what it is. They just know that it shouldn't be there. And then the other side is responsible for antibody-mediated immune response, which means, like, you get exposed to chickenpox when you're young, you produce antibodies to it, so that when you get exposed to it in the future, you don't get it. So those are the two different sides. And ideally, they should be in a balance. So if you think of, like, a teeter-totter, it should be off the ground, and both sides should be balanced. But what we know is that in autoimmune disease, one of those sides gets depressed and the other becomes dominant. So one side of that teeter-totter is sticking up in the air and the other is stuck to the ground. Hashimoto's, in 70% of cases, is Th1 dominant, and 30% of cases is Th2 dominant. So the key is to figure out which side is dominant, or just to balance the Th3 cells, which are the T regulatory cells that bring the Th1 and Th2 sides of the immune system back into balance. And there are a number of things that do that, which we'll talk about in a second. So there's a kind of general approach and then a more specific approach. And now, breaking that down into, you know, what people can do, I think a paleo type of diet that's free of food toxins, which could potentially aggravate an overactive immune system, is really important. I think addressing those underlying mechanisms that we talked about, blood sugar, oxygen deliverability, gut, adrenals, fatty acid balance, and liver and gallbladder, is really important. And then in terms of the specific focus, boosting T regulatory cell function, that would mean optimizing vitamin D status. That would mean optimizing glutathione status, because glutathione is one of the key regulators of the Th1 and Th2 sides. And then acupuncture has actually been shown to regulate the Th1 and Th2 sides of the immune system. But the single most effective thing that I know of for regulating Th1 and Th2 is low-dose naltrexone, which we've talked about a little bit in the past. I won't go into a lot of detail on it either because we could get off on a big tangent. But essentially, low-dose naltrexone works by balancing the TH1 and TH2 sides of the immune system. And that's why it's so effective for so many different kinds of autoimmune disease, because that's a common underlying mechanism. And then the last thing is that you'd want to check for iodine deficiency or bromide toxicity, because bromide's a toxic halogen that can bind to the iodine receptors and block the uptake and utilization of iodine. So if either of those are present, that will definitely adversely affect thyroid function. And I've learned, I wrote an article a while back about how iodine supplementation with Hashimoto's can be really dangerous, and it's true, it can be. But I've since learned through further research and talking with some other people that's only the case when selenium is deficient. So if you don't have enough selenium in your diet and you have Hashimoto's and you take iodine, it can flare up or trigger the autoimmune condition. But if you have enough selenium, which is the recommended amount is about 200 micrograms a day from food or supplements, then iodine supplementation should be safe and actually can even be beneficial, especially if iodine deficiency is one of the underlying causes of the Hashimoto's in the first place.
Are we talking like Brownstein size doses, or
I don't. I usually don't find those to be necessary. But the one thing that's really important with iodine is you have to start at a small dose, like 400 or 500 micrograms, and build up very slowly over time. Because even with adequate selenium, if you go too fast with iodine supplementation, you can, either trigger like a hyperthyroid kind of symptom, or you can trigger immune dysregulation. So it's good to do very slowly. I'm realizing that might not have been a big simplification that the person who asked the question was looking for, but that's because treating autoimmune disease is not simple. And that's certainly true for Hashimoto's. There are a lot of factors to consider. It's just not simple at all.
If Winnie is looking to get into this, she should check out your articles. And then, do you remember the title of that?
Yeah, you go to chriscresser.com/thyroid.
And then Dr. Krazian's book, Why Do I Still Have Thyroid Symptoms, is really great.
That's right. It's a very good book. And I've studied with him. I've taken his Mastering Thyroid course and learned a lot through that. And then just have learned a lot from my patients. I mean, I think probably 20 to 30% of my practice is Hashimoto's patients. So I don't know why that is, but it's just, it's something I have a lot of experience with because my wife has Hashimoto's/Graves. So I have a personal interest in it as well as a professional interest.
That leads perfectly into our next question. This one's from Katie. And she asks, why is there such an explosion in food sensitivity /leaky gut/celiac?
The modern lifestyle. Next question. No, I'm just kidding. Honestly, I think that's my belief. I don't really know why for sure. And a lot of people might have different answers. But my belief is that we're not living in a way that we're adapted to live. And you hear Sylvie in the background there. So basically, we are far, far away from the genetic template that we evolved with. You know, the foods that are natural for us to eat, the amount of activity that's natural for us, our connection, with the land, spending a lot of time outdoors. Fresh air, fresh water, lack of exposure to significant amount of environmental toxins. There's incredible, I think, increase in stress levels. There's medications, both over-the-counter and prescription. And I think all of that put together has had a profound effect on the gut. And what the gut, I mean, it's interesting to think about the fact that the gut is basically one big nervous system tissue. And so in a way, it's like the canary in the coal mine. It's often the first thing to go out of whack when our lifestyle and our diet is not optimal. And it's really a second nervous system. Some people think of it as a second brain. So it's really likely to be affected by all this stuff. And that's why I think we've seen this huge explosion in gut-mediated problems. And now we know that almost every disease, a lot of diseases have a gut, are mediated by, inflammatory or leaky gut, and especially autoimmunity. So I think that's a key factor. I know we talked about this on another podcast, but some researchers actually believe that you can't develop autoimmunity without a leaky gut, which is a pretty big statement.
Awesome. This one is another Facebook question. This one's from Hans, who is a great guy. He asks, do you see a connection between bad body smell and certain foods? And is a bad body smell a sign of more trouble under the hood?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I haven't seen a lot of research on this. I poked around in PubMed a little bit, and I actually found a study that was arguing that red meat eaters have worse body odor than non-red meat eaters. But it was out of, I think, Hungary or something. And I read the full text, and it was a little hokey. I'm not sure I would rely on that. But I think, what comes out of our body is a reflection of what goes in. That seems like common sense to me. And that would be true of sweat, stool, urine, and breath. One of the functions of the sweat glands in the armpits is to excrete toxins from the body. And it's primarily the apocrine glands in the armpits that are responsible for the odor. And they excrete waste, mostly protein and lipids. And, the scientific view is that the sweat doesn't smell inherently. It's when it reaches the skin that the odor is produced, because there's native flora, microorganisms, like bacteria and fungi, that are found in colonies or biofilm on the skin. And those floras, basically eat the sweat when it's excreted onto the skin surface. And then as they feed on the sweat, isn't this fascinating? As they feed on the sweat, those microorganisms produce the body odor, which is a byproduct of metabolism. So it stands to reason that the composition of the sweat would affect the odor that the microorganisms produce when they eat the sweat, right? So we have kind of like a microcosm, macrocosm here, where the microorganisms are affected by, what they're eating. And then we're affected, therefore, by what we're eating in terms of our body odor. I think one thing to investigate with body odor is stomach acid. I know if people have low stomach acid and who have trouble digesting proteins, especially, they can putrefy in the gut, and that tends to cause bad breath and body odor. So that's one thing I might investigate.
You know what? We were laughing at that study, but it's actually could be pretty accurate if a lot of people have digestive issues.
Yeah.
And they're not secreting.
Yeah, I mean, I don't doubt it. The study itself was hokey, just the way it was done. But it's true. I mean, if someone has low stomach acid and they're eating a lot of meat and they're not digesting it well and it's putrefying, that could definitely make them stink. I don't know. Maybe we should do an experiment.
I want to write an apology to that guy.
Yeah. So let's see. One more question. I think we can do it.
Cool. This one's from Janine. This one's also from Facebook. And she asks, what are your recommendations for dealing with a moderate to severe ulcerative colitis?
Okay, so ulcerative colitis is an autoimmune inflammatory bowel disease for people who don't know this, and it causes ulceration of the colon and sometimes, it's usually the colon. Whereas Crohn's disease can affect any part of the intestinal tract, you know, from the anus all the way up to the throat, although it's typically involves the small intestine and the large intestine. So what I recommend for inflammatory bowel disease in general, and also for ulcerative colitis, is the GAPS diet. So this is a diet that removes longer chain sugar molecules like polysaccharides and disaccharides, because some studies have shown that people with inflammatory bowel disorders have compromised brush border enzymes these are used to break down these longer chain carbohydrates, and when they can't be broken down, they stick around in the gut and become food for pathogenic organisms like bacteria or fungi, and then that causes inflammatory condition and even, ulceration of the gut lining. So the GAPS diet removes these disaccharides and polysaccharides, and this is very similar to the paleo diet, except it goes, one step further and removes starch. So like starchy tubers would be out because they're polysaccharides. And then it really emphasizes bone broth. Broths made from beef bones or chicken carcass, fish bones, because bone broth has a lot of glycine in it, and glycine is important in restoring the enterocytes and the gut barrier. So usually people with inflammatory bowel disease probably have a leaky gut, and the bone broth, the glycine, gelatin-rich foods can help restore that gut lining. So that's usually a good place to start, especially if the diarrhea is severe. And there's an intro version of the GAPS diet where you basically just eat meat broth, meat and broth, because even vegetables can promote inflammation or can worsen inflammation when the gut's really inflamed. So you do the intro phase until the diarrhea completely or lessens significantly, and then you move on to the next stage. There's a book, you can, I think, go to gapsdiet.com or just search for GAPS, and there are several books and resources that you can take advantage of. The next thing would be low-dose naltrexone. We talked about this earlier in the show. It's an excellent choice for any autoimmune condition. My philosophy on medicine is whatever works and causes the least harm. 98 times out of 100, that's not a drug, but in some cases it is, and I think low-dose naltrexone is one of those. It's an extremely low dose of medication. It's very well tolerated. There's almost no known long-term complications or risks, and very, very few side effects. The main one that comes up sometimes is transient insomnia when somebody starts, usually when they first start taking it, but that tends to wear off over time. Probiotics are really important for ulcerative colitis in particular. There's a probiotic called VSL number 3 that's been clinically studied. It's a very high dose, I think hundreds of billions of CFU. And there's a over-the-counter version and there's a prescription version. That can be really helpful. You want to do all of the things that I talked about in the Hashimoto's. And when we talked about Hashimoto's, like optimizing all of those underlying factors like blood sugar regulation, oxygen deliverability, gut, adrenals, fatty acid, liver, gallbladder. And then you want to do the more specific things for optimizing or balancing TH1 and TH2 function, like optimizing vitamin D and glutathione status, and then the LDN. And then I think anybody dealing with a gut problem, stress management is absolutely crucial. And that's for the reason we talked about also is that the gut is a big nervous system tissue. So stress is really torpedoes the gut, and that's particularly true in inflammatory bowel disease. Okay, we did it.
Great episode. Chris, where can we find more of your work on the internet this week? What are you doing?
What am I doing? The thyroid series is still in progress. I'm a little slower with the series these days, for probably obvious reasons.
Get on it, man.
I know you're looking forward to it, Danny. I just published an article today, which of course will be 10 days ago when this podcast comes out, on called There's More to Health Than Food and There's More to Life Than Health. So it should be fairly obvious what the topic is of that one. Check it out if you haven't already. But a thing I'm most excited about is at the end of this month, Sylvie Willing, I'm hoping to release a project I've been working on for a while now, and it's called The Personal Paleo Code. And the purpose, it's basically a three-step process to help you figure out your own ideal diet. So many people come to me, so many patients, and I see so many comments on blogs and so many emails I get. People are just completely confused about what to eat. And there's so much controversy and contradiction, even in the paleo community. You know, one person says this, another person says that, and people are just paralyzed, you know, in a lot of cases, and because everything they put in their mouth, there's like an argument for it and against it, right? And so there's a process that I use in my practice with my patients for helping people determine what is ideal for them. And this includes, you know, figuring out the optimal macronutrient ratio for them, you know, how much carbohydrate and fat and protein works best, whether dairy is appropriate or not for them, whether things like sourdough buckwheat and white rice work well. Then we get into specific tweaks for weight loss, specific tweaks for conditions like blood sugar problems, like Hashimoto's and thyroid issues, for athletes, for people with migraines. So we cover all of these things. It's, you know, it's kind of like being a patient in my practice without actually being a patient. But I'm even, you know, I'm particularly excited about some of the tools that are going to be included. One of them is a meal plan generator. So one of the things that's difficult for people is that, you know, so, like, let's say you're on a paleo diet, but you include dairy, but you're not eating nightshades, and you are eating white rice, but not, you know, and you're eating low carb. So how do you find recipes for that? I mean, you basically have to just look in cookbooks and then do the adapting and changing of the recipes yourself. And that's, you know, that's fine for people who know how to do that and who are motivated to do that. But a lot of people don't have the time or know how to do that. And so we're creating this really, it's a web application. So you'd go on there and you can choose whatever foods you want to exclude. So you can say exclude all dairy, or you can say I want to, you know, you can include butter and ghee, but take out, you know, milk or yogurt or kefir. You can exclude, excuse me, let me get a little sip of water here. So you can exclude, you know, all nightshades or just a couple nightshades, like tomatoes or potatoes or something like that. And basically you can configure it however you want, and then you hit a button to generate a meal plan, either as one recipe or a meal plan for a day or a meal plan for a whole week. And then a screen comes up with that meal plan and all the recipes in a grid, and then you click on the recipe and it shows the full recipe with a picture, and you can print it out. It has a search function, so you could go, if you have a certain, you know, you just bought some beef, you can search for beef and it will show all the recipes that have beef. And these recipes are pulled from all of the best, you know, paleo recipe sources, like Nom Nom Paleo and Health Bent, and there's Nourishing Kitchen, and just some, you know, all really, really great recipes. And then there's an index of recipe by food type and ingredient, and I'm super excited about it, actually. Like my wife is too. She's like, when's that meal plan generator going to be ready? Cause, it's, amazing to just be able to go in there and get all of that stuff just in a second to be able to like have a completely customized meal plan. And then the other tool is a progress tracking app. So I think it's really important for people to be able to track their progress when they're implementing these changes, because it can get confusing. Like, you know, if you do an elimination diet and then you start adding things back in, it's like, well, how do you keep track of how you feel and determine whether you're getting better or worse? And so we have this tool where you basically fill out a survey each week or every few days, and then it graphs, puts your progress on a graph, and it tracks things like your energy, your mood, your weight, let's see what else. My brain is a little dead this morning from sleep deprivation, but you know, you can track a whole your blood sugar and you know, pretty much any symptom that you're dealing with, and then we'll show you on a chart how you're doing over time. So really excited about it, hoping to get it done by the end of this month, and it'll be in a similar format to the Healthy Baby Code, you know, where it's all available online. And yeah, I think that's it.
Man, that blows my stupid book out of the water.
No, they're totally different. I'm not covering hair at all. So why don't you tell us about your book? Because I know a lot of my patients are going to be excited about it.
So I'm not sure if a lot of listeners know, but I actually got into health because of my own personal hair loss. I stopped it a few years ago when I actually went on zero carb, but I didn't think that going zero carb was the reason that my hair stopped. So all of my attention and my energy have been focused on what foods cause hair loss and what hormones and inflammatory markers are involved in that process. And I took a full year and I really tried to formulate and gather all my ideas on the subject. And I put them into a product that I'll be releasing called Hair Like a Fox.
Love that title, by the way. Awesome.
Thank you,
title.
Chris. And it should be ready probably at the end of this month, maybe a little longer than that. I'm definitely excited to see what happens because, in all honesty, this is kind of uncharted territory. So, I mean, I've had a lot of letters and people write me when they adopt similar ideas that positive things happen to their hair. And my old book had the Healthy Hair Diet had really good success. And people, a lot of people that adopted those ideas had a lot of success. So I think the new regimen is a lot better. So I'm excited to see what happens. That brings us to the end of this week's episode. Please keep sending us your questions at chriskresser.com using the podcast submission link. If you enjoy this show, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thank you for listening, guys.
Thanks, everybody.